one to find. You just have to look in the right places and with the right ideas in mind. This guy, the thief, he has a type. And he's been preying on a specific type of woman for 10 years. So why has this guy suddenly become so careful this year? Why is he hiding the bodies so much better? Good question, Angela said. What happened last year? What was the big story around here? Catherine shook her head. I don't know. Angela pulled more pages from her folder and passed them to Catherine. Out in Des Plaines? Catherine's eyes widened slightly when it came to her as she read the headline. Killer Clown Claims 33 as More Bodies Discovered. John Wayne Gacy, she said. Correct. The police discovered a serial killer named John Wayne Gacy, who killed more than 30 young men and buried them in the crawlspace of his home. And what? The thief got spooked by Gacy's arrest? Correct. Police activity picked up. The public was more diligent. And if the authorities had any ability to see patterns, they would have picked up on this one. Angela tapped her homemade chart again. So he changed from a killer to a thief. He still kills these women, I'm certain of it. He just hides their bodies better.
Angela, sweetheart, Catherine said. I don't really know what to say. If this is correct, even if it's only partially accurate, you need to take this to the police.
Angela looked at Catherine again. That's why I need your help.
Anything.
I can't go to the police. They'll look at me. Angela made brief eye contact again. You know what they'll think.
Bring Thomas with you.
Angela was already shaking her head. I can't tell Thomas about this. He's already worried about how I spend my days. If he knows I've been obsessing... The sound of her own voice uttering that word again caused Angela to scratch her shoulder through the fabric of her shirt. Frustration flared when her benign fingernails, clipped to the nubs, were unable to produce the searing pain she hoped for. Thomas would think this is an unhealthy way for me to spend my time.
But if it's true, Angela, if what you've discovered is true, this transcends what Thomas thinks about how you spend your time.
Catherine tapped the graph.
If this is true, then telling the police could save lives.
The front door opened, and Catherine's husband yelled into the house.
Catherine, you home?
In here, hon.
In a panic, Angela began gathering her research and stuffing pages back into the file folder as Bill Blackwell walked into the kitchen. He wore dirty jeans and a shirt covered in bits of concrete. Angela immediately recognized the appearance, since it was how Thomas often came home after work. Catherine's husband wore a bandana, which hung loose around his neck. Angela remembered the red marks on his skin and his remarks from the other night about mosquitoes and an allergic reaction and his foreman quitting, which forced Bill to run the cruise. Angela hadn't even been aware that night, preoccupied as she was with her thoughts of the missing women, that she had comprehended Bill Blackwell's words. Angela's mind worked that way, absorbing everything around her and storing it all in the deep recesses of her brain. The cataloged information randomly floated from her subconscious until she was aware of its presence. It happened to her often. Her mind would whisper to her that she was aware of something, even if she didn't quite grasp precisely what it was she understood. Then, later, the stored image or nugget of knowledge would break loose from the anchor in her mind and rise to the surface. But there was something else that caught her attention now. Angela tried not to look, tunneling her vision to the task of organizing her papers so she could leave as quickly as possible.
Angela,
Bill said.
How are you? I didn't know you guys were getting together today.
Angela smiled and offered a quick glance at Bill Blackwell. Then the other image that had caught her attention came into focus. She saw another man in the background.
This is Leonard Williams,
Bill said as the man walked into the kitchen.
He's been working up at the Kenosha shop for me. I stopped home for a quick bite to eat before heading out to a job on the west side.
When Leonard Williams appeared from the hallway and entered the kitchen, Angela immediately recognized him as the man from the alley who had tried to help with the couch. His dark eyes were less shadowed now than they had been when the morning sun had backlit his frame that day, but the dark charcoal of his orbits was unmistakable. Angela's throat closed in a momentary spasm of panic, and for an instant she was unable to breathe, causing her eyes to widen and bulge as she stared at the stranger from the alley. The man who had pushed her into a week of hysterics that had ignited her obsessive-compulsive habits. She finally pushed air into her lungs and returned to shuffling papers into her purse, some of which scattered to the floor. She hurriedly tried to retrieve them and stop others from falling, but succeeded only in scattering more pages from the table.
"Wow, wow, wow," Bill said. "Take it easy."
He glanced wide-eyed at Catherine before picking up a few loose papers from the kitchen floor and handing them to Angela, who took them quickly without looking at him. Angela didn't need to look into Bill Blackwell's eyes to see the disgusted look on his face. She sensed it. It was an expression that sent Angela back to her childhood. Most people had looked at her this way throughout her adolescence, and today Angela felt much of the confidence she had earned in the last few years slipping away. She muttered a nearly silent thank you while stuffing the pages into her bag.
"Let me help you," Catherine said, taking control of the situation and organizing the pages into a neat stack for Angela to place back into her purse.
"Angela stopped by for coffee," Catherine said. "Just a quick visit." Bill looked at the dry coffee pot, empty since this morning.
"Got it," he said. "You feeling better? Thomas said you were under the weather."
Angela nodded quickly. "Yes, thank you." She looked at Catherine. "Call me later so we can talk."
"Will do."
Angela walked past Catherine's husband and the man from the alley, hurried to the front foyer, pushed through the screen door, and raced down the steps, quickly walking along the sidewalk with her purse clutched under her arm. Inside the house, Bill Blackwell stood next to Catherine and watched Angela rush down the block. He kept his voice quiet so Leonard Williams, whom Thomas had just hired as a foreman, wouldn't hear. He didn't want his words getting back to his partner.
"I'd never say anything to Thomas. But what the hell is wrong with her? Is she a little dense? Like, retarded?"
Catherine turned her head and stared into her husband's eyes.
"She's anything but stupid, you idiot."
"Then why does she act like that?"
"Because she's a goddamn genius, Bill. And people treat her like a leper."
Chapter 10. Chicago, October 21st, 2019. Rory entered the small law firm and clicked on the lights. She walked past Celia's desk and into her father's office, where the stacks of files had shrunk since her initial visit. She still remembered the day Celia had dribbled tears onto her neck. A week later, the thought continued to bubble her skin with goosebumps and call for extra scrubbing each morning in the shower. Despite her hysterics, Celia was quite efficient. She and the paralegal had notified all of the firm's current clients about the death of Frank Moore and the need for them to find new counsel. From Celia's diligent work and research, nearly every client was either represented by a new firm or had strong leads on where to take their cases. A letter had gone out to all former clients explaining the news. In just 1 week, Celia's work was completed, her desk emptied, and the rest of the dissolution of Frank Moore's firm rested on Rory's shoulders. Rory, too, had been busy. She'd placed calls to all clients whose cases were approaching trial and explained the situation. Extensions were being filed until new counsel could be assigned. Nearly every case had been shuffled, and when she walked into her father's office this morning, there was only a single lone folder waiting on his desk. It was as enigmatic as it was troubling, and so far Rory had not been able to reassign it, mostly because the judge she had spoken to about the case had requested a meeting before Rory did anything else, but also because the closer Rory looked into the details of the file, the more curious she became about how this case had fallen into her father's hands. She spent an hour at her father's desk, searching the internet for any information she could find about the client. Rory had never known of the case during her time at the firm. But given her limited role within the Moore Law Group, this was not startling news. She had never heard of most of her father's clients, but this one carried such magnitude that she was interested to know how he had kept such tight wraps on it. Her father's history with this client was extensive, and untangling the firm from the situation would not be as simple as a few phone calls looking for reassignment. At 10 o'clock a.m., Rory shut down the computer, grabbed the loan file that remained on her father's desk, and locked the empty law office on the way out. She climbed into her car and drove downtown to the Daily Center. Inside, she made it through security and, a few minutes later, rode the elevator with a security guard to the 26th floor, where the Circuit Court of Cook County was located. The guard led her down a hallway to the judge's chambers and knocked on a closed door. A moment later, the door opened and a distinguished-looking older man appeared, white hair and wire-rimmed glasses. He was dressed in a suit and tie.
"Rory Moore?" the judge asked.
"Yes, Your Honor," Rory said as the guard tipped his hat and was gone.
"Russell Boyle, come on in."
Rory walked into the judge's chambers and took a seat in front of his desk. The judge sat in his deep-set leather throne and swiveled to face Rory.
"I've been trying to get a hold of your father for a couple of weeks. Sorry to hear about his passing. I was just made aware of the circumstances."
"Thank you."
"Thank you for coming down here on such short notice. I don't mean this to sound harsh, but for many reasons other than the obvious, your father's death comes at a terrible time. Frank and I were working on a delicate case, and the situation needs attention."
Judge Boyle lifted a file from his desk.
"Yes, sir," Rory said. "It's the last bit of my father's business that I'm trying to take care of."
"Are you familiar with this case?"
"No, sir. I wasn't familiar with any of my father's cases."
"Weren't you a partner in the firm?"
"A partner? No, sir. My father's law firm was a one-man shop. He had no partners, certainly not me. I did some side work for him when he needed help, but I wasn't active in the firm."
"What was your role at the firm, Ms. Moore?"
Rory tried to find the correct words to describe what exactly she did for her father. Her lightning-fast mind and borderline photographic memory allowed her to read briefs and comprehend the law and its loopholes better than her father had ever understood it. When Frank Moore got stuck on a case, he asked his daughter for help. Despite that she had never stepped foot in a courtroom, Rory had always been able to put together a winning strategy for just about every case for which her father had sought her counsel.
"Mostly research," Rory finally said.
"But you are an attorney, Ms. Moore? Is that correct?"
The technical answer was yes, but all she wanted to do was lie. "I'm not practicing any longer."
"Are you licensed in Illinois?"
"Yes, sir, but only as a supplement to my employment with the Chicago Police Department." Judge Boyle handed Rory a file in mid-sentence.
"Good. Then you're more than qualified to handle this situation."
Rory took the file.
"Let me get you up to speed. Your father's client is preparing for parole, and it's a touchy situation."
Rory opened the file and began reading.
"He's due in front of the parole board one final time to review my recommendations for the conditions of his release, which is scheduled for November 3rd. The hearing will be the day before. Your father and I were hashing out the details, and I'm afraid you're going to have to put on your lawyer's shoes for the hearing. It's mostly a formality, as the board will go along with all of my recommendations, and I've already approved all of theirs. But nonetheless, we all need to cross our T's and dot our I's on this one. You'll have to appear with him."
Sir, I'm not sure that's a good idea.
I've dragged my feet on this for as long as possible, but the parole board has made their decision and I've spoken to the governor about it. There's no way to stop this from happening, so I'm going to make sure it goes as smoothly as possible now. There was a shitload, excuse my French, of details I worked out with your father. Many terms of the release were negotiated. We had everything just about settled.
Judge Boyle pointed at the file in Rory's hands.
Make yourself familiar with the details so we can discuss the final terms next time you and I meet.
Your Honor, I'm working to reassign all my father's cases. I'm not taking them on myself.
I'm afraid that's not an option in this case. Unless you think you can find someone to handle it for you by next week.
Can I request an extension?
Your father has already requested several. I can't kick this down the road any longer. There's too much attention on this case. Your client has been in the news lately, and he's due in front of the board in 2 weeks. Before then, and when you're familiar with the case, you and I will talk about the specifics of his parole. Let's get this man's affairs in order and get his file the hell off my docket.
Sir, I'm not suited for a courtroom, or parole boards, or for lawyering in general. Judge Boyle was already out of his majestic leather chair and on his way to the door of his chambers.
I suggest you find a way to remedy that situation before you come out of retirement next week.
He opened the door and stood next to it. Rory took her cue to leave, her knees buckling slightly when she stood. After she gained her bearings, Rory cleared her throat. What did this guy do that makes a simple parole so complicated?
He killed a whole slew of people back in 1979. And now a few idiots on a parole board think it's a good idea to let him out of jail.
Chicago, August 1979. Angela jogged the 2 blocks home from Catherine's house, raced up her steps, and pushed through her front door. She rattled the frame closed and twisted the deadbolt with trembling fingers. Her breathing was labored from her frantic march home, during which she constantly looked over her shoulder to make sure no one was following her. With the door securely latched, she leaned her forehead against the frame, her breath shallow from having come face to face with the stranger from the alley. She tried for the last week to stop the image of his deep-set eyes from trickling into her mind. She'd done a good job today of replacing that image of the stranger's face with those of the missing women as she worked out her theory that the thief had been lurking for much longer than this summer. But now, since seeing the man at Catherine's and knowing Thomas and Bill had hired him, Angela's tightly tethered paranoia had broken loose. She spent an hour checking the locks and windows, picking up the phone 100 times in a row. She called Thomas's office, but there was no answer. Her index finger became raw from punching the numbers on the phone. She settled into a mindless loop of dialing Thomas's office number into the phone, pacing to the back door, peeling the curtains to the side, and staring out into the alley. Back and forth for hours, until she finally heard the deep rumble of Thomas's Ford truck turn down the alley and saw the garage door begin to open. The growl of her husband's truck, a noise that usually irked her the way all loud noises did, today brought comfort. Angela's skin was burning as she waited for Thomas in the kitchen. When the door opened, Angela immediately recognized the concern on her husband's face.
"What's the matter?"
he asked, rushing to her. "I saw him again," Angela said. But Thomas was paying no attention to her words. He grasped her wrists gently and examined her hands, lifting them to his face to get a better look. For the first time, Angela noticed her bloody fingertips. Thomas moved his hands to her upper arms, pulling her sleeves away. Angela had unknowingly removed the long-sleeved button-down shirt she had worn to the library, which Catherine had questioned. She stood now in a white T-shirt, the sleeves of which were soaked with bloodstains, from where she had dug at her shoulders and opened the scabs that were hidden there. "What's going on?" Thomas said.
"You're covered in blood, Angela."
She felt him wipe her forehead and eyebrows, where her bloody fingertips had left crimson streaks from pulling at her lashes.
"He was at Catherine's. Bill hired him."
"Slow down," Thomas said, looking into her eyes. "Slow down and breathe."
Angela swallowed hard and tried to control her frantic respiration. She was like a child who had cried ferociously and was now trying to speak. She exhaled a few times and allowed Thomas's grip on her shoulders to right her mind.
"I was at Catherine's house today."
"Okay."
"And Bill came home."
"Okay."
"And he was with the man from the alley, from when I tried to get rid of the couch."
"Who was it?"
"Bill said he works for you. He runs the warehouse up north."
Thomas furrowed his brow and then cocked his head.
"The Kenosha warehouse? That's Leonard."
"He was in Catherine's house. He looked right at me."
"Leonard Williams? Are you talking about Leonard?"
"Yes!"
Angela screamed.
"He was the man from the alley!"
"Angela, it's okay."
Thomas tried to pull her into his chest, but she resisted like a child working to prevent a parent from lifting them.
"But I saw him in the alley."
"Leonard lives in the area. He was probably out walking that morning." "This is good news, Angela. You see, Leonard is harmless. He runs one of our warehouses, that's all."
Angela felt Thomas pull her close again, this time allowing it. She rested her head on his shoulder, her chest still heaving, but no comfort came from her husband's embrace. Worry was all she could do and all she could feel. It was all her mind would allow. It filled her chest, her head, her soul. Thomas whispered into her ear,
"I think it's time you start seeing your doctor again."
Chapter 11. Chicago, October 22, 2019. It was mid-morning on the day after her meeting with Judge Boyle. Court was in session, and the hallways were vacant when Rory walked through the Dirksen Federal Courthouse in the Loop. Her combat boots rattled with her gait and echoed off the walls. Rory found the courtroom, pulled her gray coat tight to her neck, opened the heavy door, and slid silently into the back row. The pews were mostly empty, but for the first three, which were lined with young men and women Rory guessed were students of the distinguished Lane Phillips. Groupies, she thought, who followed the good doctor everywhere he went. Lane's court appearances brought high fervor for the young lads who hoped to see their mentor in rare form on the stand. Rory admitted that a Dr. Lane Phillips court appearance could rival any other type of entertainment. Lane was testifying as an expert witness for the prosecution in the case of a double murder that took place the year before. A man was accused of killing his wife and mother in a fit of rage. Rory hadn't seen much of him in the last week because he had been preparing for his time on the stand.
"Dr. Phillips," the attorney asked from behind the podium, "you mentioned earlier that your specialty is in forensic psychology. Is that correct?"
"Correct,"
Dr. Phillips said from the witness chair.
Lane Phillips was approaching 50, but looked like he was in his 30s, with mismanaged hair and the remnants of a once prominent dimple on his right cheek, which flashed when he smiled. His casual attitude toward anything that came his way made him popular with the students, who looked up to him like a deity. His laissez-faire style, messy hair, black jeans, worn sport coat, and no tie, surely spoke to the young audience that filled the front pews. Whenever Lane spent the night at Rory's place, he never took more than 10 minutes to shower and dress in the morning. His efficiency made Rory Moore, who was far from girlish, look like a beauty queen. Lane's appearance stiffly contrasted with the sharp-suited attorney cross-examining him, whose hair was perfect and whose cufflinks shined brightly as they peeked from under the sleeves of his tailored suit. Even before Rory took into consideration the discussion between the two men, it was obvious they were rivals.
Is it also true, Doctor, that you serve often as an expert witness in high-profile cases?
The profile of a case is not a variable in my decision to serve as a witness.
Very well, the attorney said, walking from behind the podium. But it is true that you often testify as an expert witness in cases of homicide, is it not?
Yes, that's true.
Usually your expertise is sought to help the jury understand the mindset of the one who stands accused of murder. Is that correct?
Oftentimes, yes, Dr. Phillips said.
Lane sat upright with his hands folded in his lap, oozing a calm confidence against the attorney's aggression.
In this case today, you've offered the jury quite a detailed look, so to say, into the mind of my client. Is that fair to say?
I offered my opinion on your client's mindset when he killed his wife and mother, yes.
The attorney let out a subtle laugh.
Objection, Your Honor.
Dr. Phillips, the judge said, please limit your comments to the questions being asked and offer no more conjecture on guilt or innocence.
Excuse me, Your Honor, Dr. Phillips said, looking back to the attorney. I offered my opinion on what someone might be thinking if they had shot and killed their wife and mother.
This got a subtle reaction from the students. The attorney nodded his head and offered a small smile as he ran his tongue against the inside of his cheek.
So, as in today's earlier testimony, and in the many other cases in which you've served as an expert into the criminal mind, one might guess that you are employed by a government agency, say, the FBI.
He shook his head.
No.
No? Wouldn't a distinguished mind such as yours be put to good use in the Criminal Investigative Division or in the Behavioral Science Unit within the Federal Bureau of Investigation?
Dr. Phillips opened his palms.
Perhaps.
The attorney took a few steps forward.
You must instead be in private practice, then, counseling such individuals on a regular basis. Surely that is how you came to be such an expert on the criminal mind.
No, Lane said calmly. I'm not in private practice.
No?
The attorney shook his head.
Then please tell us, Dr. Phillips. With all of your advanced degrees and your many publications in forensic psychology, where exactly do you work?
The Murder Accountability Project.
Yes,
the attorney said, gathering papers and reading from them.
The Murder Accountability Project. That's your pet project that has supposedly developed an algorithm to detect serial killers. Do I have that right?
Not really, no, Lane said.
Please enlighten us, then.
First, it's not a pet project. It's a legitimate LLC corporation that pays my employees and me a salary. And I didn't supposedly develop anything. I actually developed an algorithm that tracks similarities between homicides across the country to look for trends. These trends can then lead to patterns which can help law enforcement solve homicides.
And all these homicides you help to solve, how many of the accused perpetrators do you deal with personally as a psychologist?
My program identifies trends to help law enforcement track potential killers. Once we see a pattern, the authorities take over the case.
So the answer to how many of these alleged murderers you end up counseling as a psychologist would be zero. Is that correct?
I'm not directly involved with any of the accused that my program has helped identify.
So, calling yourself an expert in psychology when you no longer practice the profession is a bit misleading, is it not?
No, sir. Misleading is dressing in a shiny suit and calling yourself an attorney, when really you're just a hack throwing insults to distract the jury.
Lane's students tried unsuccessfully to mute their laughter.
Dr. Phillips,
the judge said. Lane nodded.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
The attorney, unfazed, went back to his papers. You are also a professor at the University of Chicago, is that correct?
Lane looked back at his rival.
Yes.
A professor of what, exactly?
Criminal and forensic psychology.
I see, the attorney said again, walking back to the podium with a trying-too-hard, confused look on his face and scratching his sideburn. So, you run a business that claims to identify killers, but you don't work in any capacity of psychology with those killers. And you teach the psychology of the criminal mind to young college students. I'm struggling to understand where your practical experience comes from, Dr. Phillips.
I mean, you've offered so much information about my client's mindset and what he must have been thinking in the days leading up to the night his wife and mother were killed.
Insights such as the ones you offered have to come from practical clinical experience working with men and women convicted of violent crimes. But it looks to me like the prosecution has put on the stand a so-called expert witness who runs a business that sells algorithms and data to the police and who teaches psychology to college kids. Doctor, have you heard of the axiom, those who cannot do, teach? Objection, the prosecutor said as she stood from behind the table. Withdrawn, Your Honor. I have no more questions for Dr. Phillips. The DA was heading to the witness box. Dr. Phillips, prior to taking a university faculty position and starting the Murder Accountability Project, where were you employed?
At the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
For how long?
10 years.
And what was your role within the Bureau?
I was hired as a forensic psychologist.
And your job was to analyze crimes to determine the type of person who may have committed them. Is that accurate?
Yes, I was a profiler.
During your tenure at the Bureau, you worked on over 150 cases. What was your clearance rate in those cases, where your expertise in profiling the perpetrator led to an arrest?
I had a close rate of 92%.
The national average for clearance rate of homicides is 64%. Your success rate was 30 points higher than that. Before your tenure with the Bureau, Dr. Phillips, you wrote a thesis on the criminal mind titled Some Choose Darkness. That thesis is still widely heralded as a comprehensive look into the mind of killers and why they kill. Please tell us, Dr. Phillips, how you gained such insight.
I spent 2 years during my PhD studies on sabbatical, during which I traveled the world interviewing convicted killers, understanding motive, mindset, empathy, and patterns of how a human being decides to take another's life. The dissertation is a well-received and peer-reviewed document.
In fact, the DA said, more than 10 years after your thesis was published, it is still popular in the forensic community. Am I correct?
That's correct.
In fact, your thesis is used as the main training tool around which the FBI teaches new hires who join the Bureau as profilers. Is that correct?
Yes.
In addition to your dissertation, you also compiled your findings on serial killers of the last 100 years into a true crime book. Is that correct?
Yes.
As of the latest printing, how many copies of that book are in print?
About 6 million.
No more questions, Your Honor. Chapter 12. Chicago, October 22nd. 2019. Rory entered the tavern on the afternoon after Lane's courtroom appearance. She and Lane sat at the corner of the bar and ordered drinks. Rory took off her beanie hat and removed her glasses. There were few people in this world Rory Moore felt comfortable around. Lane Phillips was one of them.
The bartender placed a surly darkness stout in front of her and a light beer in front of Lane. Rory made an ugly face when she looked at Lane's beer.
What?
He asked. Your beer is the same color as urine.
That dark stuff hurts my stomach.
You hurt my stomach, Rory said. Why do you put yourself through that crap?
On the stand? Every expert witness has his credentials questioned. It's part of the gig. Gotta have thick skin to deal with it, and you have to see it for what it is.
The defense is attacking me to distract the jury from the fact that his client killed his wife. If my credentials need to get shredded in order for my opinions to be heard, that's okay with me, as long as the son of a bitch is found guilty.
I hate bullies.
He's just doing his job.
Lawyers are the scum of the earth, Rory said, taking a sip of stout.
Says the lawyer next to me. And he's right, by the way. I haven't practiced psychology for years, and I haven't dealt directly with the criminally insane for more than a decade.
That might be about to change. I need a little help.
With the Camille Bird reconstruction?
Rory thought briefly of Camille Bird, whose photo she had pinned to her corkboard days before. Her father had died of a heart attack just after she agreed to take the case, and tying up his affairs had been an all-encompassing task. A pang of heartache struck as Camille's face popped into her thoughts. Rory had all but abandoned the case, and the guilt of leaving a cold case unattended suddenly felt heavy on her shoulders. She made a mental note to put in some hours on the reconstruction, once she had this last file of her father's settled.
No, something else, she finally said.
Rory reached into her purse and pulled out the file Judge Boyle had given her. I've got my father's firm pretty well settled, besides this one case. She pushed the folder across the bar and saw Lane's posture straighten. Paging through a criminal's file gave him a thrill. And despite any stiff-suited attorney trying to convince people otherwise, Lane Phillips was one of the best at dissecting the mind of a killer. He'd resigned from the FBI not because his profiling skills were suspect, but because he was too proficient at it. Diving into criminal minds left him shaky and tormented by what he found there. He understood their minds so well that it left a haunting impression he had difficulty shaking off. So when his true crime book, which chronicled the minds of the most notorious serial killers of the last 100 years, including personal interviews with many of them, sold more than 2 million copies during its first year in print, he quit the bureau and started the Murder Accountability Project with Rory. The MAP was an effort to track unsolved homicides and identify patterns that might highlight similarities between crimes, often pointing to serial killings. Rory and Lane's skills complemented each other. She was able to reconstruct homicides better than anyone in the country, and Lane Phillips was one of the world's foremost authorities on serial killings. Ever hear of this guy? Rory asked as Lane paged through the file.
Yeah, they called him the thief. But Christ, that was 40 years ago. Your father represented this guy?
Apparently. I'm still sorting the details. Garrison Ford, the big criminal defense firm, originally handled the case. My father worked at Garrison Ford after leaving the public defender's office, but his tenure was short, just a couple of years. When my father left to start his own firm, he took this case with him. Lane turned a few pages in the file.
When was the last time your father worked at Garrison Ford?
1982, Rory said. And he's had this guy as a client ever since.
Doing what?
Lane asked. That's what I'm trying to figure out. After Garrison Ford mounted an unsuccessful defense at trial, my father worked on appeals and represented him at parole hearings. The guy also has a small fortune from before he was put away, and it looks like my dad oversaw the money. Set up a trust and protected it for 3 decades. Settled some debts, looked after some property, and paid himself out of the trust for legal services rendered. Lane turned the page.
And visited this guy a lot. Look at all these visitor log entries.
Yes, my father had quite a relationship with this man.
So what's the issue? Pawn this case off like you've done with all the others.
I can't. This guy's been granted parole. My father was working with the judge on the details when he died, and his honor is under some pressure to get it off his docket, so he's not letting me delay it. Lane took a sip of beer as he continued to page through the file. Rory picked up her stout. Tell me about this guy. I looked him up. He was convicted on a single count of murder, too. Doesn't seem like it would be so spectacular that he made parole after 40 years. But when I talked with the judge, he said the guy killed a whole bunch of people.
Oh, boy,
Lane said, looking up from the file and staring at Rory.
What?
Rory asked.
Something's piqued your interest about this case, hasn't it?
Stop it, Lane.
I know how you operate, Rory. Something about your father's involvement in this case has planted itself in that brain of yours, and now you can't let it go.
With her father gone, Lane Phillips was the only other person who fully understood Rory's obsession with things unknown. His history as a psychologist stopped Rory from pretending he was incorrect. Dr. Phillips knew the workings of the human brain well, and Rory's in particular better than most. This quirk in her personality was what made her such a sought-after forensic reconstructionist. Until she had all the answers about a case, she was helpless to stop her mind from working to find them, especially if an initial glance at a case held something that made no sense, and her father's involvement with the man the papers called the thief made no sense at all. Tell me about this guy, she said again. Lane wrapped his hand around the bottom of his beer mug, spun it in place as he collected his thoughts on the long-ago case.
The prosecution pushed for murder one. The jury came back with second degree for the lone victim. But this guy was suspected in many other cases of missing women,
Lane said.
5 or 6. I'd have to look it up.
5 or 6 homicides? Nothing in his file mentions other victims. And it would be impossible to make parole if he killed so many.
He was suspected of more killings, never charged. And you won't find anything formally linking him to the other killings, just rumor and conjecture.
Why did they go after him for only one homicide if they thought there were more? Lane closed the file.
A few reasons. The city was in a panic in the late 70s. You had the Son of Sam still lingering on people's minds. He was the nut who killed a bunch of people in New York in 1976. Then here in Chicago, we had the horror of John Wayne Gacy having killed and buried 30-some boys in his crawlspace. Then, during the summer of 1979, women started disappearing and the city bubbled with fear. The whole summer was filled with heat and anxiety. Eventually, toward the end of the summer, the police found their man. But the way they discovered him was very unorthodox. And it was entirely thanks to an autistic woman who pieced it all together.
Rory leaned forward across the bar to listen more intently. She was more interested now than she had been.
The method in which this woman gathered and delivered the evidence was very strange, and the DA knew none of the evidence would stand up in court. Most was flat out inadmissible. Neither side wanted a trial. If the prosecution failed to convince the jury of his guilt, this guy would walk. If they succeeded, he'd be eligible for the death penalty, which was still around in 1979. So a trial was risky for both sides. In the end, the DA made the choice to go after him on the single homicide. They had shaky evidence, a lot of circumstance, and no body.
No body?
No. That's why it was such a risk to go to trial, and why they went after him for only the single victim. No bodies were ever found, besides one that they could never tie to him in any meaningful way. And with no body, the jury came back with a guilty verdict for murder, too. The conviction sent him away for 60 years, but allowed for parole after 30. The sentence put the city's fears to rest.
And now, after 10 years of parole hearings and 40 years in jail, he's about to be granted his freedom. Lane shook his head.
I studied this case for my book, but the details never made it past the final edits.
That woman who figured it all out?
God damn, I still remember the headlines.
Schizophrenic woman brings down the thief. Schizophrenic?
No one knew anything about autism back then. Plus, schizophrenic sold more papers.
Rory looked into the black abyss of her surly darkness stout, lifted the mug and swallowed the rest of the beer. She wanted to order another. She longed for a touch of dizziness to soften her thoughts about this autistic woman she knew nothing about. She knew those curiosities were taking root in her mind, and that they would be impossible to ignore. She stared up at Lane. Whatever happened to her? The autistic woman. Lane tapped the file with his finger.
Her name was Angela Mitchell. He killed her before she had a chance to testify.
Chicago, August 1979. 2 days after her breakdown, Angela was at the doctor's office, sitting on the table in a thin gown and pulling at her eyelashes. "Relax, darling," the nurse said as she prepped the syringe. "I just need 2 vials. You won't feel a thing." Angela looked the other way when the nurse pressed the needle to the inside of her elbow. But it wasn't the threat of a needle that had her on edge. Her panic attack had set Thomas's radar on high alert, and he'd forced her to see the doctor before things got out of control. Little did he know that things were far beyond that. Bearing her paranoia to Thomas had set loose even more angst now that she was at the clinic. She'd been through this routine before. Most of her adolescence had been spent in doctor's offices and on psychiatrists' couches. Back when she was under the rule of her parents, doctors and shrinks were her way of life. Her parents believed that if Angela saw enough of them and the right ones, they could psychoanalyze her back to health. When none of the therapists could do for their daughter what Angela's parents demanded, they admitted her to a juvenile psychiatric facility. Angela was 17 when her parents forced her into that place, and she spent 7 months there until she discharged herself on her 18th birthday. It was only with the help of a dear friend that Angela had escaped that life. She had been on a mostly smooth trajectory for the last several years. Since meeting Thomas, she'd tightly managed her anxiety and had even felt like she was starting to fit into society. Her autism was something no one understood, including the many doctors who pretended otherwise, and Angela had long ago stopped trying to explain to others how her mind operated. She had learned over many years of criticism and failure that no one could fully comprehend the way her thoughts were organized. Yet here she was again, waiting for a doctor to explain what was wrong with her. She knew, though, that Thomas meant well. His eagerness for her to seek psychiatric help was simply his way of trying to protect her. He didn't know her full history. Angela had tried her best to keep hidden the dark days of her teenage years. And until just recently, the ruse had worked. Thomas had opened her life to new opportunities. He made her feel safe. But despite the progress, the events of the summer had made her realize how frail a hold she had on it all. The missing women who had run through the folds of her mind, and the idea that they were part of a longer string of violence, had started Angela down a road with no turnoffs. Despite Angela recognizing that her obsession with these women was unhealthy, she felt a connection to them that she couldn't ignore. The stranger from the alley, who had reappeared in Catherine's kitchen, had set loose her anxiety in ways that transported her through the years and back to her adolescence. The obsessive-compulsive disorder she thought she had tethered and stowed in a locked-off compartment of her psyche had been reawakened to wreak havoc, like when she was younger. On top of it all, she feared that her affliction would push Thomas away. She feared now that Thomas had gotten a clear look at her paranoia. The anchor that had steadied her for the last couple of years was breaking free from its mooring,
to leave Angela adrift and alone. So many worries ran through her mind, she had trouble keeping track of them all.
All done, darling, the nurse said, bringing Angela's thoughts back to the present.
The nurse held two vials of deep red blood in her gloved hand.
The doctor will be right in.
A few minutes later, the doctor entered the room and performed a cursory exam.
Have you had panic attacks in the past?
The doctor asked while he scribbled in the chart.
No, she said. I mean, when I was younger, but they didn't call them that.
The doctor took a minute to finish writing and then looked at Angela.
You used to take lithium as a teenager. Was it effective?
Angela, who normally would shy away from a man staring at her, peered back with an intensity that surprised even herself. The horrors of her teenage years fueled her rage.
No! He forced me to take it, and my parents went along with him.
Who?
The psychiatrist my parents sent me to, the one who kept me locked away in the psychiatric hospital. He believed I had a behavioral disorder and that I was a manic depressive. They used lithium to sedate me. Besides putting me to sleep, it gave me wild hallucinations.
The doctor paused before nodding.
Yes, not everyone responds to it.
He pulled a prescription pad from the breast pocket of his jacket and jotted on it. He tore the page free and handed her the slip.
This is for Valium. It will take the edge off with none of the side effects of lithium.
He jotted again onto the pad and tore a second slip free.
And here is the name of a psychiatrist. I think you should talk with someone. I've been referring many of my female patients to him lately. The missing women from the city have gotten a lot of people spooked. Talking with someone will help. In the meantime, push fluids until the vomiting passes. The Valium should help, and... Mrs. Mitchell?
The doctor said as he stood.
The police are good at what they do. They'll catch this guy. That will be the best cure for everything you've got going on.
On the way out of the clinic, Angela crumpled the paper that held the shrink's name, dropped it in the trash bin, and climbed into her car. She walked into the pharmacy 10 minutes later to fill her Valium prescription. Chapter 13. Chicago, October 23rd, 2019. Rory put a call into Detective Davidson. He owed her after the setup with Camille Bird's father. Now she was calling in the favor. She needed everything he could find on the old case from 1979. Having scoured the dark corners of Cook County federal buildings in search of what Rory needed, Ron came through, delivering 3 boxes of information to her door earlier in the afternoon. Now the boxes were stacked next to her desk while Rory pored over the details. She had emptied the first box and spread the contents onto her desk. The facts about the 1979 case fascinated her. More than anything, the enigmatic woman named Angela Mitchell, who had managed to identify a serial killer, drew all of Rory's attention. Rory felt a strange connection to the woman from 4 decades ago. Angela Mitchell had done essentially what Rory did now. She put names and narratives to victims in order to reconstruct crimes. The defense team who represented the thief, of which her father was a member, had created a biography of Angela Mitchell. It described her as a socially awkward 29-year-old woman who suffered from autism and a limited ability to understand her surroundings. An obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, the report continued, limited her abilities to handle the activities of daily living. And at the time during which she collected the evidence the prosecution had been allowed to present at trial, she was on heavy doses of Valium. The report went on in length about Angela's troubled adolescence, her time spent in a juvenile psychiatric hospital, and her estrangement from her parents. Taken on its surface, the account painted an unflattering image of Angela Mitchell. The more Rory read, though, the more connected she felt to the woman from years ago. Their stories were similar in many ways. Although Rory was never estranged from her parents, quite the opposite, and she had never been forced into a psych ward. Rory's childhood had been plagued by many of the same ailments as Angela's. Instead of shipping Rory off to doctors and hospitals, her parents had sent her to Aunt Greta's house during the summers and on most weekends. Although no medication was forced on Rory, Aunt Greta offered different remedies for Rory's social anxiety. Without her great-aunt, Rory's childhood might have been written about using the identical language as Angela Mitchell's. She pushed the thought of Angela Mitchell's supposed Valium addiction from her mind, working hard to prevent the comparison to the glass of Three Floyds Dark Lord Stout that rested in front of her. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and Rory was on her second glass, her head vertiginous with the early effects of the alcohol. In a show of rebellion to her own thoughts, she lifted the glass, took a long swallow, and then spent 2 hours on the 1979 file, lost in the details of Angela Mitchell and what she had managed to do. Rory made it through 2 full boxes, but left the third untouched for now. She turned to her desktop and typed the name Angela Mitchell into the search engine. After scrolling through pages of links that had nothing to do with The Thief from 1979, Rory finally came across a few general articles that rehashed some details about the case. None of the online hits held revelations that were not already in the boxes next to her. She was ready to shut down her computer when she came to a link for a Facebook page titled Justice for Angela. The page had 1,200 followers, and the last post had been made 2 years prior, a short paragraph dated August 31st, 2017. Today marks the 38th anniversary of my dear friend Angela Mitchell's disappearance. So many decades later, and there are still no leads on the case. Few members of the Chicago Police Department even remember Angela, and those that do are long retired and gave up hope long ago of discovering what really happened to her during the summer of 1979. Those of us who are part of this online community looking for answers know that no resolutions were provided during the farce of a trial that took place in 1980. With each passing year, it seems more and more likely that the only one who could shed light on the truth is sitting in jail. He, of course, refuses to utter a word about Angela. As always, anyone with tips or information about Angela Mitchell can comment on this thread, and I'll follow up with you personally. The smallest detail, even this many years later, could be helpful. The Facebook post included a grainy image of Angela Mitchell. It was actually a photo of a photo. The person who posted it had used a cell phone to capture the old Polaroid picture, which was yellowed and faded by age, the camera's flash reflecting off the upper corner of the plastic photograph. Rory looked at Angela Mitchell. She was a petite woman who, in the photo, stood next to a taller woman, who Rory assumed was the author of the Facebook post. In the snapshot, Angela smiled shyly at the camera, her gaze slightly down and to the left, unable, Rory understood, to stare directly into the camera's lens. Rory had the same affliction. Lane had been correct with his assumption earlier at the bar. The seed of curiosity had been planted in Rory's mind, and stopping it from growing was as impossible as stopping the sun from rising. She was initially curious about the case because of her father's involvement, but now, since learning more about the mysterious woman at the center of it, Rory felt the familiar pull of interest she knew she couldn't ignore. It was the same feeling she encountered at the start of a reconstruction. Some part of her mind would be unable to rest until she knew everything there was to know about Angela Mitchell. She finally looked away from the gritty Facebook image and did something she would never normally consider. She clicked the mouse over the comment section and typed quickly. My name is Rory Moore. I need some details about Angela Mitchell. Please contact me. Rory hit the return key before she could reconsider, scrolled to the top of the Facebook page, clicked the About icon, and pulled up information on the person who created the page. The woman claimed to be Angela Mitchell's closest friend from the summer of 1979. Her name was Catherine Blackwell. Chicago, August 1979. The Valium was helping. She hadn't vomited in 3 days, and the headaches came less often. The medication was dulling the urge to dig at her scabbed shoulders, and the drug's overall effect was blunting her paranoia and keeping Thomas's concerns at bay. Angela was taking twice the suggested dosage, though, and she worried not only about over-medicating herself, but also about what would happen when the pills ran out. Thomas had been watching her closely since the breakdown, and Angela worked hard to keep things together and convince him that since her visit with the doctor she was feeling well, that she had her short relapse under control, that the identity of the stranger from the alley, while at first disconcerting, had now led to relief, and, most important, that she didn't need to see a psychiatrist.